yourself get into a comfortable position and let your body relax as much as you can. And just become aware of your body. And just the act of being aware of it will help it to relax. Aware of your feet, your ankles, your calves, and your knees, thighs, your hips, and your torso. Just aware of your back and your shoulders. Your abdominal area, your chest. Be aware of your arms, your upper arms and your elbows, your forearms, wrists, hands, fingertips. Your shoulder area, your neck, the back of your head, the sides, your ears, the top of your head, your face, eyes, nose, cheeks, mouth, chin, tongue, and just suggest your body to relax. And to relax a little more. And enjoy the sensation. And now take some deep, even breaths. And be aware of your body and the breath as you do that. The relaxation. Let your mind relax. Whatever thoughts are there, fine. Just let the thoughts be taking place in a very relaxed mind. Happy thoughts, agitated thoughts, sad thoughts, neutral thoughts. Just give all of those thoughts out into space as though your mind is completely letting go, completely relaxing, completely detaching in a sense. From any tension the thoughts might normally cause. Instead, just be interested in enjoying the deep relaxation. Any part in the body that seems tense, just let it relax. Just go to that part, be aware of it, and suggest that it relax. in any thoughts that might be there, just accept them as they are. Be relaxed. Let the body relax even more deeply. As though were the very muscles attached to the bones. Relax at that depth. Then just be aware of your breath. As your body continues to relax, just notice the ingoing and outgoing breath. Now just notice your own presence, the me, your own sense of self. You, the one who has this body, the one who's breathing, the one who has thoughts. Not the body, not the breathing, not the thoughts, but me. The one who has the body, the one who has the breath, the one who has the thoughts. Is there anything more dear to you? Than this very presence, this being that you are? Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Verse 4. Yata darpana bhava apasaha nao. Yata darpana bhava apasaha nao. Mukham vidyate kalpanahi namekam. Mukham vidyate kalpanahi namekam. Tata divi yoge nirapasako yaha. Tata divi yoge nirapasako yaha. Sanityo palabdhi swarupo hamatma. Sanityo palabdhi swarupo hamatma. Sandhi. Yata darpana abhave. Abhasa hanau. Mukham vidyate. Kalpana. Kalpana hinam ekam. Tata di vyoge nirabhasakaha yaha sa nitya upalabdhi swarupaha aham atma. This verse begins with a doubt, so I'll introduce it with a doubt before I translate the verse. The Bhashya presents, Shankara presents an interesting doubt. It goes like this. If you remember from the previous verse, previous verse said, the face, the reflection of the face which is seen in a mirror is not a real object. There's no real object there separate from the face, separate from the real face, right? There's no real thing there separate from the actual face. So the reflection in the mirror has no being apart from the real face. Okay? Like that, the jiva, right, this transmigrating me, I am, the one who I consider to be the body, mind, sense organs that transmigrates, like that, the reflection of consciousness in the intellect, in everybody's intellect, which we call the jiva, like that, that is not real. Right? That reflection is not any more real than the reflection in a mirror. It's the consciousness itself that is real, not the reflection in the mirror. That's the idea. I am that pure consciousness. I am that self whose swarupa, whose nature is consciousness, which is free from time. Nitya upalabhi swarupa. Okay. So that was the verse. So now, Shankara making connecting links between each verse, he says, well, if the self is like that, if that's the situation, says Evam Sati, when the self is like that, then Atmanah Sukadukadi Sambandha Abhavat. Because there then is no real connection, Sambandha means connection, between the self and Sukha and Dukkha, pleasure and pain, right? Because if that all belongs to the reflection, right? If there's no connection between sukha and dukkha and the atma, which was part of the objection he brought up here, this is just to make that clear. For instance, if I'm looking in a mirror, right, I see my face, but what if the mirror has some dirt on it? Right, then I see the dirt on my face. Right? So what if the mirror is all dusty? Then I'm dim. What if the mirror is shiny and clear? Then I'm shiny and clear. It's got little black, there's got little black marks on it. I've got little black marks on my face. But actually now, I understand that all of those impurities, pleasure, pain, all of those impurities, right, belong to the mirror, belong to the buddhi, belong to the mind, not to the self, right? So he says, and not only that, it belonged to the mirror, for instance, and they have no connection to the self. Right, the little black marks in the reflection, right, aren't really touching me at all. But there's no connection there. And so the verse is saying, well, like that, with the buddhi, all of the, what we call the doshas, all of the impurities, the problems, the imperfections, you know, sorrow, all of the emotions, sorrow and hatred and anxiety and depression and all of these different emotions that we don't like, right? All of these belong to the buddhi, to the intellect, to the mind. And they have no connection whatsoever with the Atma. So he says here, because there is no connection, if what you say is true, because then there's no connection with sorrow and happiness, joy, happiness, etc., all of these emotions with the Atma, they have no connection, then there is no bondage. Bondage nasti, there is no bondage. Why? Because there's no connection with the Atma, none of the sorrow and all of these things, there's no connection, if this is what you say. Then he says, and therefore, because there's no bondage, bandha abhavat, because there's no bondage, then there's no moksha. Right? If there's no bondage, then how can there be moksha? Right? Because, he says, it's the one who is bound that needs to be liberated. Right? You're not the one who's not bound. It's exactly what he says. He says, buddha hi muchate, because the buddha, I mean, buddha hi muchate. It's because the one who is bound, the one who is bound, muchate, is liberated. Na abaddha, not the one who's not bound. And then he says, similarly, so that's obvious, right? If there's no connection between sorrow and whatnot with the self, then there's no bondage, and therefore there's no liberation. But he doesn't stop there. Then he says, but then say, all right, bondage and liberation are for the chidabhasa, the reflection of consciousness. Bondage and liberation are for the reflection of consciousness then, which is what it says in the, for the chidabhasa. It uses that word. Okay, so but he says, similarly, bondage and moksha for the reflection of consciousness also can't be there. Why? Because the chidabhasa is not real. Well, think about it, you know. The mirror, the reflection of the mirror, in the mirror. The reflection of the in the mirror, just my face is reflected in the mirror, and it has dirt specks on it, because there's dirt specks on the mirror. Now, that's the chidabhasa. Are we going to liberate the reflection in the mirror? He would say no. Well, why not? Well, because it's not real. There's no being there. It's the Atma that's real, so you're not going to liberate the reflection, right? The reflection in the mirror, you're not going to liberate the reflection of the self in the mind. Why? Because it's not there. That's not where it exists. The face is not there in the mirror. Right? There's a reflection there, but there's no face there. There's nothing there to liberate. So consciousness is not something there belonging to, existing in the buddhi, in the intellect, as an object that belongs to it in order for us to liberate it. So that's not there because of astutvat, because it's not a real thing. And he says, and then again, there is no bondage and liberation for the buddhi also, the intellect. There's no bondage or liberation for the intellect, for the mind. Why? Because the mind is something which is continually changing, thought after thought after thought after thought after thought. It's born and it goes, it's born and it goes. What are you liberating? It's already gone before you can catch it to liberate it. Because the mind is inconstant. The mind, the buddhi means the intellect, the mind, all of the thoughts. They're constantly changing. So, in fact, they're liberating themselves every moment. So, since they're constantly changing, you can't liberate that either. So he says, tetahacha, there, and so therefore, the moksha shastra, the scripture, the Upanishads, shastra means the scriptures that deal with moksha, that deal with liberation, the moksha shastra, is anarthakam. It attains the status of being anarthakam without any purpose. It's useless, right? It has no meaning. It's artha means meaning or purpose. Anarthakam means without any meaning or purpose. So this moksha shastra that you talk about is silly. It's useless. It has no purpose at all. Thus, to counteract that, this verse. That's how Shankara introduces it. It's kind of nice, isn't it? So he gets back in this verse, Hasdam Malakin, this verse 4, goes back into the, we're back at the mirror now. So he says, yata, just as darpana abhave abhasaha now, just as when there is the destruction, hani means the destruction or the loss of something, just as when there is the loss of the abhasa, the reflection, when the mirror is not there. Darpana is mirror. Abhava is the absence or the non-existence. So here, so you have a mirror. The darpana abhave, when I take that mirror away, okay, and the mirror is gone, then the abhasa, the reflection that is in the mirror, is gone, right? So when that reflection is gone, when I take the mirror away, the reflection is also gone. Mukham vidyate. The face is. The face remains. Mukham means the face. The face, vidyate, remains. Kalpanahinam, without the reflection. The face alone, the mukham ekam, the face alone, the one face itself, remains. Without, the kalpana is the projection. You know, it means talking here about the reflection. The face alone remains, face itself remains, without the reflection. Right? Just think of that. I have a mirror there. The reflection is there. Just try to imagine. I want you to imagine this experientially. Now, be aware of your face and be aware of your body, okay? Now, imagine you've got a mirror there, okay? And you, your face, your body, the whole your own self-experience, is now seeing the reflection in the mirror, okay? Now that mirror is removed. The reflection is now gone. Okay. What is left? You are left. Your face, you, are left. Okay, so now, think of it like this. Again, we've got the mirror here. Looking at the mirror, I see the reflection. Now, where does the face experience exist? The face, the being of the face, the experiential being of your face, where does it exist? So if you take the mirror away and you bring it back, you take the mirror away and you bring it, the reflection's there, reflection's gone, reflection's there, reflection's gone. What doesn't change at all is the being which the face enjoys, the existent face. So think of it like that. The existent face, because the existent face, the being of the face, is experiential. If I have the mirror, I'm seeing the face in the mirror. But the being of the face is not experienced in the mirror. The being of the face is experienced in the real face. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? The sensation of the face is experienced in the real face, not in the reflection. So I remove the reflection, and I'm still there. The being of the face is there. Right? Okay, so now, think about it like this. Let's go to the next line. Tata, similarly, Di-vyoge. In the removal, in the separation, vyoga means separation. The buddhi. Di means buddhi, the intellect, the mind. Remove the mind, in the separation of the mind. So in the di-vyoge, nir-abhasakaha yaha. The one who is without the reflection, the one who is not the reflection, that one without nirabhasaka means without the reflection. The one who is without the reflection when the buddhi is removed. I am that one. So it goes, to get make the sentence correct, ayamatma says ahamatma. I am that self. I am the Atma, the self, whose nature is nitya upalabdhi swarupa, whose swarupa, whose nature is consciousness which is changeless, nitya, free from time. I am that Atma, which is pure consciousness, free from time, free from past, present, or future. I am that consciousness who, when the buddhi, in the absence of the buddhi, remains without the reflection. Nirabhasakaha. Do you see this? So the whole teaching, this whole teaching of the Upanishads, when we use the Upanishads as a means of knowledge, as a pramana, I need to recognize the difference between my being and that which can be removed. Right? The reflection can be removed. If I have a thought, I can say, you know, I am my thought, but the thought can be removed. What isn't removed is the being that the thought enjoys. I can see myself in the mirror. So I remove the mirror, the reflection is gone, but the being of me is not gone. Right? If I remove the buddhi, my being remains exactly the same. But now, without the reflection, what is the reflection? I am this thought, I am that thought. Say you have a thought that is a sorrowful thought. A sorrowful thought, okay? Then, I am sorrowful. That's what we talk about, the reflection. I am that. Right? So I'm reflecting off of that because I can identify with it. I am happy. I'm reflecting off of that. I am agitated. I'm reflecting off of that. But if I get rid of the vritti, the one who was reflecting off of it remains without the vritti. That I remain without the vritti. And so it's this me, this one who is constant, that has to be recognized. Okay? And so now, this is where he starts answering the little objection he brought up. He says, buddhya dao, on the buddhi, on the mind, pratibimba rupena, in the form of a reflection, adyasya atmanam. Okay, there's some important words here. This is the important word. The important word is adyasa. Adyasa means superimposition. Right? That's superimposition. Anyonya adyasa means mutual superimposition. Anyonya, other. Anyonya means mutual. So mutual superimposition. Having superimposed adyasya, myself, on my mind, right? Having superimposed myself on my mind. Having done that, I take on the qualities of the mind. Right? Having superimposed the mind upon me, my mind takes on me. So my mind, right, which like a mirror, right, reflects me, becomes the conscious being, and the conscious being becomes the mind. That's what we call mutual superimposition. It's this mutual superimposition that is the problem. And this mutual superimposition is different. Like, for instance, look at this. As he brings out in his commentary, yourself, the Atma, has no problem. It's not connected with the thoughts. The thoughts come and go. Right? If the thought is a sad thought, that comes and it goes. The happy thought, it comes and it goes. It's asanga. There's no connection there whatsoever. So for the Atma, there is no bondage at all. For the Atma, there's no problem. There's nobody to be liberated from the standpoint of the Atma. And if it was just the mind coming and going that had no relationship with the Atma, then there would be no problem there at all either. But what's happening is that this mind has taken itself to be me. Right? And the mind, since it has taken itself to be me, having superimposed itself upon me and myself upon it, then I become bound. Right? The mind is bound. The mind is always changing. It has this emotion and that emotion just by its nature. By bound, what I mean, it exists within time. It changes. It comes and goes. It's subject to birth and death. It's subject to change. That's the nature of the mind. If that mind had no association with me, then there's no problem. Right? And again, look at it this way. That mind, it has no association with me, so I have no problem that it comes and goes and changes and has moods and all of that. That's fine. That's the nature of the mind. Right? And it has no problem. It would have no problem either with itself. It comes and goes. That's its nature. Right? So it's free to be itself, and I'm free to be myself. And all is well. There's no bondage or liberation. Everything is just as is. But because of self-ignorance, a problem occurs where I take on the characteristics of the mind, and the mind takes on the characteristics of me. Okay? Now, from the standpoint of me, the Atma, Nitya, Upalabdhi Swarupa, just the pure conscious me. From that standpoint, no matter what the poor mind does, it makes no difference. But from the standpoint of the mind, who has made this superimposition because of ignorance, it's no longer the mind independent of the self. From the mind standpoint, it is the self. Right? And since it takes itself to be the self, then whatever it is, I become. And that's where the bondage comes in. Everybody kind of understand that? There is no bondage, really. There is no problem. But as long as there's self-ignorance, the mind doesn't know there's not a problem. The mind does experience a problem. The mind is the problem. Right? Really, actually, the mind itself isn't a problem either. It's the ignorance that the mind is suffering from that creates the problem for the mind. And what is the problem that it creates as well? The mind is in a condition of experiencing continual pain. Because it's acting in the world and acting toward me and acting toward the world in a way that the world isn't. And mind is going around madly, you know, trying to find myself. It's trying to find that which is stable, that which is not subject to death, that which is the locus of fullness, that which is trustworthy, where it can just relax and say, ah, all is well with me. It's looking all over the universe for it. It's looking all over the universe for myself. And that's the that is exactly the problem of ignorance. So here he says, it is this adyasa, the soyam adyasaha. It is this adyasa, it is this superimposition that is bondage. Soyam adyasaha bandaha. It's this superimposition that's the bondage, he says. And it's atmajnanena ajnanam nivritya bujyari prapancha nivritya adyasa nivritti moksha. He says, and moksha, liberation, is the removal of this adyasa. It's nothing more. It's the removal of this adyasa, right? How? The removal of the adyasa through the removal of the ignorance through self-knowledge. There's nothing else to be done, right? There's a problem of self-ignorance, and that self-ignorance has to be removed. It's very, very simple. It's that this simple me, that when I'm sitting here in this body, mind, sense organs, who I take to be myself, this conscious being that I am, where when you say right now, when you say I am, I exist, that ahankara, what we call the I notion, that ahankara is labeling you the one who is free from the body, the mind, the sense organs. The one who is this nitya upalabdhi swarupaha, the one that is timeless consciousness. Right now, when you say I am, that is who you are talking about. Not somewhere else. Not some meditative experience. It's the very... And I think this is what is so tough to realize. When you say right now at this moment, when you say I, that I is landing on your sense of self, the me that wants to become liberated. That I want to become liberated. And it is this I, this very I that you're referring to, that couldn't be more you than it is right now. It is this I that is Brahman, and not another one. This very being that is not big, it's not small, you know, it's not infinite in size or infinitely small. It's free from size. It's just simply, purely me. It is never, ever not there. When that adyasa, that ignorance goes away, it's shocking. There's no superimposition. There is no adyasa. There is no superimposition. There's no time at all that you are superimposed on anything. Your being is always absolutely the same. But the superimposition, this phenomena, takes place on the part of the mind who just simply and innocently so just simply assumes that I am it. Because wherever the mind is, I am. Wherever a thought is, I'm there. Whatever a feeling is there, I'm there. So, from the standpoint of the mind, I'm always me. From the standpoint of the mind says, I'm always me. Now I'm a happy me. Now I'm a sad me. Now I'm an agitated me. But I'm always me. You see that? It's true. What it doesn't realize is that the sadness, the me, remains always. The sadness goes, the agitation goes, the happiness goes, this thought comes, that thought comes, that thought comes, that thought. And what doesn't come and go and all of that is me. And so when I understand that, this very simple me is not fluctuating at all. And all of these thoughts, feelings, perceptions come and go in me. They're not me, because The me doesn't go. And so this very personal me that is me right now, when you say, I am the body, the me that you're referring to is Brahman. When you say, I am happy, the me that you're referring to is Brahman. When you say, I am miserable, the me that you're referring to is Brahman. Right? There's not another me out there. But now, look at, if this is clear, then when you have a meditative experience, a quiet mind, an expansive experience, a detachment from your body even, which we can get just by deeply relaxing the body. The mind can detach from the body. You can have an expansive experience, subtle experience. Now the me, the same me, is present to this beautifully profound experience, which comes and goes, right? Because you become active again and your mind is, you know, engaged in the world. If the profound experience is not any more me than the negative experience, if you want to say, I am the truth, I am the being of the profound experience, and I am the being of the most negative experience, I am the being of the very neutral experience, I am, that's okay. But if you say, ah, finally I've gotten to meet myself, I'm the profound experience, I have revealed myself to me, then I'm identified with a type of a thought. I need to recognize the one that's present to that beautiful thought and the one who's present to the dull thought or the agitated thought, the constant me. And that I need to gain through self-knowledge. And self-knowledge has to do with what? Differentiating, right? The seer from the seen, really. The reflection from what remains. The reflection from the actual being. The reflection example is really pretty nice, because even when you think of it in terms of the mirror, when you think of holding up a mirror, the mirror does not enjoy being. The mirror reflection does not enjoy your experience of being. Does everybody see that? It's just so beautiful in that way. What is real, you are the one who is real there. And in the same way, you are the one who is real in reference to your mind, in reference to your experience. And you don't come and go. When the mind realizes that, it's so happy because it has a home. Right? There's somebody solid here that when the mind is acting up or having problems or whatever, it can relax into that benign presence, which is me. I think one thing we just touched on it in the meditation today, there is nothing more dear to you than yourself. And by that I don't mean the thoughts that come and go, I mean the one who has the thoughts. You know, you don't want your thoughts if you're not going to be there. Would you rather have your thoughts or you? No, I'd rather have me. Would you rather have your body or you? I want me. You know? So that's very profound to understand how dear you are to yourself, you know. If you want to get rid of sorrow, right, you want to get rid of the sorrow for your sake, who is that one who doesn't want sorrow? Who is that one? Yeah. If you think it's great, this idea of heaven, going to heaven, or the transmigration of the soul, that's a nice idea, reincarnation, you know. But for that to be meaningful to you, who is it that has to reincarnate? What is the sense of self, the me, that needs to reincarnate or go to heaven in order for that to be meaningful. Because we usually think of, oh, some soul goes up to heaven or some soul is reincarnated, but that, what about me? I don't want to die. When we say, I don't want to die, who is that? In your own presence, even if you take yourself to be this physical body, what in this physical experience, the totality of this, if I say, I am this body, what is it that you are most attached to in terms of your own presence? See what I mean? I don't mean attached to like, oh, I'm attached to the object, this object. But in terms of your own meanness, your own presence, what is it that is so precious? To let the mind focus on that. Because that is Brahman. That is Brahman. That is yourself that we're talking about. Because there is nothing more precious. So if you can find something more precious, then that's what we're talking about. So it, really, like if you were to go and say, oh, well, this is precious, but no, I can imagine something better. No. This, you can't imagine anything better. Because then you'd have to say, would I want the self to be different? You can't say that. It's impossible to say it. You can say that about a thought. You can say that about a feeling. You know, or a meditative experience or an experience of joy. Oh, I could have more joy than this. That's an experience. But if you go to your own presence and say, do I want to change me? Not the thought, not the feeling, me. Then you can't say that. If you can say it, then look further. And so that, once you can differentiate that one, then you ask, okay, if that's really me, I won't be able to get rid of it. Because nitya, free from time. So then try. Try to get rid of it. Try to cover it. Try to have a thought where that's not there. You can't. Have a painful thought. You have a painful thought, but it doesn't get rid of you. There's nothing you can do. You can't move it, change it in any way. Doesn't matter what the thought is. A happy thought, you can have a happy, blissful thought. That doesn't change you. It's you're there, the very being, the one, you know, who is present to that thought. That's moksha. That is moksha. Because nothing can do it. You can't do anything to yourself. A thought can't do anything to you. You can't do anything to you. Nothing can do anything to you. And there's nothing more dear. That's freedom. You can't hurt yourself. Nobody can hurt you. Your mind can't hurt you. That's the end of it. Okay, then you say, well, I want my mind to be happy. Yeah. Okay. I want my mind to be happy. That's where the emotional lag time comes. Because my mind has spent beginningless lifetimes thinking, I want that to be happy, I want that to be happy. Externalizing, you know, I want that to be happy. Once it realizes, once the mind realizes, not myself, but realizes myself, and understands that the experience of happiness that the mind has ever enjoyed and ever will enjoy it is myself. And the mind is relaxed like a clear water bucket reflecting the sun. You know, when my mind relaxes, my being reflects in the mind in ways that we call happiness or joy or bliss. And the more relaxed the mind is, the more happy experience the mind has. The mind gets agitated. It's like a muddy water bucket. Then it's as though the sun goes away. So, I have spent lifetimes trying to clear the muddy water bucket. By I want this so I can be happy. I fulfill that desire, and for that moment, my mind becomes clear, and I experience happiness. This is how we've lived our life, lifetimes. I want this so that I can be happy. If I don't get it, once I've projected myself on it, the superimposition, once I've projected myself on it, I want that so I can be happy. If I don't get it, I become terribly unhappy. And some of you have caused me not to get this, and I don't like any of you, and I know you all helped me to try to get it, and thank you, but you know, that's how it goes. And then when you fulfill a desire, your mind is quiet, and so you feel happy. So this has given me the happiness. This unfulfilled desire has given me the unhappiness. Really, all that's happened is that because I've made that projection onto the world, my mind sometimes is tense when I don't get my way. And when I do get my way, for that moment, my mind relaxes and I experience happiness. This is lifetimes of this. At some point, you realize this. I hope this isn't the truth, because these moments of happiness are so fleeting. I fulfill the desire, I have a moment of happiness, and the object remains, and I still lost my happiness. You know? So where is the locus? Where is the happiness that I experience? Once you understand the trick, you know, the illusion of what's going on here, your mind, then when it knows that really the only reason it's ever happy at any time is that it's relaxed. And the reason it experiences the happiness is because, like the sun reflects in a clear water bucket, my being reflects in that mind and gives me experiences, gradiated experiences of happiness and joy and all of these type of things. What about when my mind knows that, there's, and understands it, it slowly owns up to that knowledge. Until after some time of kind of forgetfully going out just habitually, I want that so I can be happy, and then getting burned and getting upset and having your mind go through all of this samsara, it time and time again, after repeatedly behaving ignorantly, and then your knowledge coming along and saying, well, you know, that's because... Look at yourself, look at the locus, you know, where the ananda really is. Your knowledge starts owning up. Yeah. And you can't stop that process either. Once you know, your mind will behave ignorantly, but your mind knows you're behaving ignorantly. You know, and so slowly, 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 it stops it. It stops behaving like that. And so the ananda that I seek is my own being, and it roots there for its happiness, and then happily experiences the world. Happily, it has a desire, and if it doesn't fulfill its desire, that's okay. Right? So happily you have your desires. Happily you happily you live your life. Happily you experience the ups and downs of life. Why do I say happily? Because you're not at stake, and your mind knows it. And so the mind then slowly relaxes. You can't expect it to, after lifetimes of building a network built on self-ignorance, to just clean its act up immediately. It takes some time. But once you know yourself, you are there present to the mind as it straightens itself out. And so that becomes enjoyable, watching the mind straighten itself out and learn and mature. Because you're not at stake. I'm exactly the same whether my mind is behaving maturely or not. That it's behaving immaturely does not harm my knowledge. You know, I'm still exactly the same, illumining my immature mind. And I also know how to be with my immature mind. I can be kind and patient, just like you are with your child. You know, you teach it. You bring it up. And you let it learn. Because you're not being hurt in that process. Right? And so you can be kind to your mind and let the mind mature. Otherwise, you're asking too much of it, as though lifetimes of superimposition are going to be eradicated in an instant. That network's going to be eradicated in an instant. Actually, what I think a better way to understand it is, once you know yourself, you recognize yourself, that recognition doesn't go away. You're free. But what we call this pratibandhika jnanam, this jnanam with obstructions, the mind is not totally living up to what it knows. And so it causes pain. Right? But you're there. It's not causing pain to you, it's causing pain to yourself. And so because of that, your mind has a locus, it has you to depend on. Everybody see that? It's a very beautiful thing. Once that's understood, then you can kind of be patient with the mind. It's like being patient with samsara, being patient with the universe, letting things, you know, grow. Things grow and flourish in kindness. They always use the example, you know, just like a little plant grows if it gets sunlight and water. Right? Then it'll grow, it'll flourish. And for us, what is our sunlight and water? It's love. Kindness. That's what it is, love. And so, to the parts inside of ourselves that are hurt and need to grow and need to mature, what's the sunlight? It's kindness. For any human being, what's the sunlight? It's kindness, that's it. Yeah. And what keeps it thwarted and small? Meanness, anger, criticism, judgmentalness, you know? And so if we inflict that internally on ourselves, then there's no sunlight for those parts to be nurtured. You know, so that love is the sunlight. It's interesting because sometimes love as the self and the sun are, you know, equated together in terms of illustration. But there's nothing more nurturing for one's peace or one's growth than love. And we know how to love others, you know, but somehow we leave ourselves out. You know, which is such a shame. But once we understand, then we can do it. I've told I think all of you many times through the years anyway, that for me the thing that was the most revelatory as I was just learning, studying with Swamiji, and I was in India and only been with him for maybe 6 months or so, I discovered that kindness to yourself. My mind was so grateful that all of a sudden there was somebody inside. I found that part. Because something he's simple, he had said. But I got it. You know? That there was a part in me that could be kind to all the other parts. And supportive and helpful. And loving. And I felt my whole psyche transform around that. Permanently. And I'm not talking about knowledge now. I'm just talking about attitude. You know, that attitude of that finding that part that cares. But then all of a sudden, in your own inner environment, there's love there. Doesn't matter if somebody, part of you is hurt or wounded or angry or has done the wrong thing, you know, that all the mistakes we make and all this, there's somebody there that cares and doesn't feel it's not anything about being critical, it's about trying to help. And I always, that's one thing why sometimes having the blessing of being able to kind of grow up with your guru, live with your teacher, like in an ashram environment or something like that. And for me, being able to spend that time with Swamiji. Criticism is not, in him, it doesn't even exist. It's not there. And you know it's not there. He's not about that. He's just interested. And if you do some stupid thing, what were you doing? What was that about? You know? And that kind of ability, you know, to take you fresh. You make some mistake or irritable or cranky or pouty or whatever, God knows, you can do. You know? That ability to take you fresh. Every moment, every day, all the time. To experience that from somebody, you know, allows you to internalize it. You know, but we can learn to, hopefully we get that from somebody in our life, but we can get it to ourselves if we understand. Yeah. Understand how we want somebody to be toward us, or how we value being toward somebody else. We can be that internally. And it's just a huge, huge relief. The psyche. It's a good start. You know? And then when you acknowledge, once you know yourself, right, then yourself really becomes the inner friend without words. Your own being is the wordless inner friend that's just always there. And then the inner friend personification is something that's really talking from the standpoint of that self. Standpoint of that love. So, okay, let's take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Was something tonight. I was, it seems like it's really, I'm always during this teaching trying to figure out, okay, is this the self? Is this the I thought? Is this the mind? You know, like I can't get that, like I feel like I have to separate that super opposed thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then this other thing is happening, which is that I just keep getting happier and happier and happier, which to me, I think is what you're saying, is like my mind must be relaxing, like on some level I'm getting it, and so my mind is just not struggling so much or something.
Well, yeah, I actually think that that's true. As one starts understanding, that even incrementally, that understanding relaxes the mind. You know, and so that relaxation, and because the relaxation that you get is caused by knowledge, it's, I kind of call it like the baseline relaxation. Even though you can still be hurt or agitated and react and all of these kind of things, you know, that are slowly working themselves out, there's a baseline of relaxation that keeps increasing. Yeah, which means that the mind's baseline peaceful feeling increases.
And that me that you talk about is not belonging to us, or it's not belonging to any us, ourselves.
I would say like
the
this.
The me is not belonging
to?
To, the me is not belonging to, it's not belonging to anyone.
Well, you know, that's true. That language is a little tricky, because if you say, like, that this me is not belonging to anyone, in the mind, what the mind can be thinking is that it doesn't belong to me. You say the me is not belonging to anyone, then it's not belonging to me.
And I mean not belonging.
Well, that's what you were saying. Those were the
it's
words.
It's hard to put in words.
Yeah. So let me put it in words that also don't work. The me that you experience as yourself. If I were to get rid of the whole universe, the me that is me now is still going to be there. And so I am, in fact, the very being from which this whole universe comes. This me is very personally me. You know, it's the me I identify right now. Let's say the mind says, I am. It is this I am that it's referring to. So it's not like there's any other me experience than me. So there's no, I can't get a more personal me. This is the personal me. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just that this person, very personal me, this very personal me experience that is me, is only one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got it? Yeah. Language is tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of which, at Yasa, this position, mm-hmm. you qualified with another word,
Anyonya. In Anyonya, the word Anya means other. Anya, Anya, Anyonya, but other, so mutual, yeah.
So what does that mean, mutual, super?
The example, I'll bring it to the self in a minute. The example they use is the red-hot iron ball, where you've got the iron ball and the fire. The iron becomes red and hot, right? So the fire is superimposed on the iron. That's one side of the mutual superimposition. So the iron becomes red and hot. But the fire becomes round and heavy. So the fire takes on the qualities of the iron ball, and the iron ball takes on the qualities of the fire. So the two, that's the mutuality. So here, like say between the mind and consciousness, the conscious being, and it's the mind that's creating this problem, right? Because consciousness isn't saying anything. But the mind becomes the conscious being. And the conscious being becomes the mind. So the conscious being then becomes somebody who's subject to being happy and sad. Now the mind, the conscious being becomes sukha, dukkha, suki, dukki, I'm happy, I'm sad, and this and that. Because it's given the qualities of the mind. And the mind, on the other hand, is given the qualities of consciousness. The mind becomes a conscious entity, And consciousness becomes somebody who's fluctuating in whatever way the mind is. So that's the mutuality.
But if the self is not bound by time or space, then how is it possible? How is this whole mutual superimposition possible?
Well, in this way, the self is not subject to the mutual, to the ignorance that's caused the mutual
mind.
Superimposition. Right. But it's the whole problem's in the mind, not the
right.
self.
Okay.
Okay.
That,
oh, you got it?
Yeah.
Can you see how it's mutual, though, in only in this sense, that the self by the mind is taken to be thinking, and the mind is taken to
it's
be conscious.
It's seemingly
okay.
changing.
Totally seemingly.
Right.
Yeah. There's no reality in it at all. But it's. But you know what? These.
But it happens.
it causes problems. Yeah, well, it doesn't really happen. Well, it does happen. The ignorance happens,
yeah.
right? And ignorance is powerful. It's like, you know, the rope snake story. The boiled boy who mistakes the rope for a snake. Well, boy, he feels he's bit and he has emotions. He's going to die and he's crying and all of this. Or the missing tenth man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
you even have a heart attack.
Yeah, I mean, ignorance, even though something has never happened, if you think it's happened, you have all of the, it's your reality. Yeah.
Carol, if all names and forms are not real, but it, and Maya is not real, is Maya superimposed on Atma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it didn't. You said before it was beginningless. So I was wondering, what was those two words you used? Is it like creative capacity or?
I did use creative capacity, but when we say Maya is beginningless. Right, well, that's exactly what it means. Nobody created it, right? Who's going to create it? Brahman, is timeless and free from any parts. So Brahman's not going to create Maya. Maya's not going to create itself, right? And Maya's responsible for the projection of time and space and everything within it. So we say that this Maya, if we say it's unreal, what do we mean by that really? Is that the substance, the being of it, is Brahman. Maya itself is everything that we say to be an object here is infinitely divisible. We can't find an object here. We can't find a substance here. And everything in this creation changes. It has a birth and it has a death. So every single thing is bordered by non-existence, and we can't. We start out, say, okay, every single thing, because it's subject to change, comes into being and goes out of being, so it's bordered by non-existence. And then we say, well, what about this thing we call a thing? We say, well, what is the thing? What is the object? And we can't find an object, because every object is infinitely divisible into smaller objects. So, and when we say Maya is unreal, it's not unreal in the sense that it's not here, not being experienced. It just has no ultimate being apart from Brahman.
How did something changeless give a rise to everything?
It didn't. It didn't give a
That's
rise
what
to
I was
anything.
Wondering, what
That's
why
we
those
say.
Two words that you used to.
Well, we say that. See, Brahman can't create Maya. Brahman can't create anything. And Maya can't be away from Brahman. Because there is nothing else but Brahman, but being itself. And so, Maya, Brahman is timeless, so it's not, it has no beginning, because it's free from past, present, and future. It's just timeless being. And Maya can't have any beginning, because who created it? And time, space, and everything exists within Maya, as a projection of Maya. And so then Maya and Brahman go together. But Maya has no way to change Brahman. It's kind of the relationship to kind of understand kind of what it's like. It's just the relationship you have with your mind, with dream. Right? Your mind or your thoughts, your imagination, it doesn't touch you. It's not away from you. But it can't change you or touch you. But where are you going to put it?
So nothing gave rise to Maya.
No beginning. To have a beginning, you have to get in, you have to be in duality, to have a prior condition. But duality exists because of Maya, not because of Brahman.
So there's something that's always changing, Brahman. I mean, never changing, which is Brahman, and something that's always changing, which is Maya. But they're one and the same.
They're not one and the same.
But everything is Brahman.
Everything is Brahman.
Well, then Maya is Brahman.
Maya isn't Brahman because we have two words. So put it like this. I can say Maya is in Brahman in the same way that I could say, if I use clay pot, the same way I could say that the pot is the clay. I could say there's nothing but clay there. Right? There's nothing but clay there. But then there's a pot. No, there isn't.
So like our bodies, our physical makeup is, you said it gives a rise to our own creation. Is that because the
that
changing
what?
Structures?
The physical body what?
Like our being, our physical aspects that are all superimposed on Atma, that gives us the ability to have our own creation. Like everything, you know, everything projects out of us and resolves back into us.
Or like a dream or something?
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, in the sense of, here you have this upadi, body, mind, sense organs, and it has certain capacities. Right? Like your mind can imagine. But if I were to kind of dissect this body and try to find the self, that a conscious being here, I'm not going to find it in the body. I'm not going to find it in the mind as an object. It's going to be the nature, the kind of the non-objectifiable nature of the subject. Actually, I think for this to make sense, I'm being way too terse for you. I really have to be able to unfold it step by step. It's kind of not fair to talk like this, because it's assuming too much
but
without
Maya,
unfolding.
So Maya is superimposed on Brahman?
If I use the word, why I'm a little hesitant to say it like that, is that the superimposition requires like an act of mind. In other words, my mind is superimposing one thing on the other. So if I want to say Brahman, Maya is superimposed on Brahman, well, according to me, the jiva, it is. Right? Because I...
Because we are Maya, right? I mean,
yeah, the body, mind, sense,
right.
Organs is Maya, but from my vantage point as a jiva, I say, this exists, this exists, this exists. I give the being of Brahman to all of the objects, and I give all of the objects to the being of Brahman, so they're all superimposed with no differentiation between Brahman and the universe. Whereas Brahman's not having any problem, and Maya's not having any problem. So who's having a problem? Well, the mind of the individual who has ignorance. Ishvara's not having any problem. So it's this individual here within the Maya that has a problem because I, this body, mind, sense organs, I take myself to be a limited being where, in fact, I'm the whole. So that's a big problem. If my swarupa, if my nature is the whole, and I'm taking myself to be a little being subject to birth and death, something's not working for me. Because I don't understand how I can die and why I'm not whole. I can't understand that because I don't die and I am whole. So what's going on? You know, it does nothing works. So that's the ignorance that's causing a huge problem.
What's the difference between the words Maya and Mithya?
Mithya is an order of reality. Maya falls under that order of reality. So the order of realities are, if I were to say, the three basic order of reality is Paramarthika Satyam, absolute reality, means that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. Mithya, and I'll get to that in a minute. The last one is Tucham, absolute non-existence, like the horn of a rabbit. In between is Mithya, which is that Sadasad Bhyam Anirvachaniya, that which can't be defined as real, Paramarthika Satyam, or Asat Tucham, absolute non-existence. The whole Maya everything that exists within duality falls under that order of reality. So Maya is mitya in terms of the order of reality. That Maya is the material responsible for the projection of the creation made of the sattva, rajas, and tamas. See what I mean? So we say this whole creation is Maya. What's the order of reality? Mitya. The only paramartika satyam, the absolute reality, is only Brahman. Right? Because that's what's not subject to time. Past, present, or free from time.
The ignorance began in the moment of that two-pronged body and the mind, right?
We say that ignorance is beginningless. Because the prior condition would be knowledge. And if there was prior condition would be knowledge, you know yourself. If you knew yourself, then you're not going to forget yourself because you're never not yourself. You know, if I can see that painting and then go away for it from a while and forget about it. I can forget it because memory, you know. But yourself isn't something that you keep in your memory because you're always there. So the ignorance is beginningless. It's the Maya is beginningless. The Jiva is beginningless. There's an end to it. That's the extraordinary nature of ignorance, is that it's beginningless, but it comes to an end. Like, for instance, the example they use, say someone you've never seen before walks into the room. Right? When did the ignorance of that person begin? Well, it didn't begin. But it comes to an end. Right? Your knowledge of the ignorance could begin. The ignorance didn't begin, but it comes to an end upon seeing the person.
So it arose in and of itself, Maya did.
The what?
Maya and Atma both, and Brahman, all arose in and of itself.
Atma is Brahman, okay, and it's beginningless. It means free from time. So beginningless isn't even the right word for it, because timeless. Okay. So it didn't arise. It always is. And Maya is beginningless because it's not created.